Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Redemption Hill podcast. We are a community of people learning the way of Jesus to bless our city of Boise, Idaho, and beyond. Redemption Hill is a unique place. We are a collective of micro churches that do life together throughout the week and gather on Sundays to grow, worship, and celebrate what God is doing in our city. You are invited to join us Sundays at 9 a.m. at Discovery Church in Boise, where you can find the community you need in any season of your life. More details can be found at redemptionboise.org. Up next is the teaching segment from this week's Sunday gathering. Afterwards, stay tuned for more information on how to get connected at Redemption Hill.
Good morning. Morning, Redemption Hill. I'm Bob. I am one of the elders and part of the teaching team here. We've been, and you can take me down a little bit, I'm ringing in my own ears. We've been working our way through the book of Genesis, trying to get a sense of who God is and who we are and we're created to be and what we should do about it. Last week, we were introduced to a man named Abram, who was later called Abraham, the man from whom most of the world, Christians, Jews, Muslims, trace their spiritual heritage. We're going to talk a little more about Abraham today and read a very surreal story from his life. We're going to talk a little bit about the crazy world and times in which he lived. But before we do, speaking of crazy world and times, how is everyone doing? Yeah, so, not good. Okay, all right. It's been interesting not just to watch the news lately, but to watch people watching the news. My sense is that there is a general what in the world is going on kind of running through a lot of folks' minds. So here's my question this morning, and this is non-rhetorical. What are you worried about in this present moment? What has you concerned? And don't worry, this isn't like a trick question. You know, I'm genuinely interested. What are you worried about? What has you concerned? Yeah, Grandma Robin. It's sometimes hard to trust God with people you don't trust. Okay, all right. What else? Yeah. What's that? Yeah, deaths of civilians, quite a few. Yeah, and somebody, yeah, Dacia. Yeah. We do tend to try to control that which is outside of our control and exert it somehow mentally. You know, you drive by Fred Meyer and you're going, 409, that's not right. Go down. What else? Yeah, Joe.
I think it appears things are getting worse.
Yeah.
And it makes me afraid of what my kids are going to have to deal with.
Yeah, exactly. It appears as though things are getting worse, and it can be easy to become afraid of what your kids might have to deal with. Blaze, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's difficult when God's name is slapped onto some very rough things that are happening and some very awful things, for sure. Anything else? I mean, it seems a bit, I mean, you wouldn't be too far out there to think that things are spinning a bit out of control. We're in a war that's not a war. Dropping bombs on other countries, including on their civilians. Thousands are dead. Over 1 million people are displaced. 20% of the world's oil, 400 million barrels a day, disappeared from the market overnight, which meant that oil prices have gone up 50%. So gas prices rose 30% in the last month and will likely go higher if that drags on. In fact, I was reading some economists are saying that this could lead to a worse situation than the Arab oil embargo in the 70s, where gas was being rationed and lines were miles long. Other countries are already experiencing shortages and blackouts and rationing. It feels like we're on worse terms with not just our enemies, but even with our friends than we've been in a long, long time. Russia is feeling emboldened in Ukraine, and China is making worrying moves around Taiwan. I would not blame anyone for feeling a bit worried or a bit of disequilibrium right now. I wouldn't blame you for worrying about the future or even wondering if there's going to be one. So what does all this have to do with Genesis? I bring all this up because as we dive back in with Abraham, I imagine he was feeling some very similar things. Worried, frightened, off balance, wondering if there was going to be a future. In Genesis 12 that we looked at last week, God called Abram to leave his home country and go to a place that he had never been. And then God made him a promise that Abram would have many, many descendants, and God would bless the world through him and through those descendants. And all of this, in spite of the fact that Abram was 75 years old, and he and his wife, who wasn't much younger, had never been able to have children. And as soon as they arrived where God told them to go, there was a famine. And they were in danger of starving. So they had to head south into Egypt just to survive. And after coming back from Egypt, back to where God had told him to settle, war broke out. Three kings and kingdoms against five. And when one group finally defeated the other, they plundered the whole region, taking everything, including Abram's nephew Lot and his whole family and all their possessions. And so Abram had to gather a small army himself and go after his nephew and fight to rescue him. I mean, did you get all that? No. Famine, war, kidnapping, having to go after. I mean, God had promised Abram some big things, but so far, leaving home had meant nothing but disaster and hard times. And still, no children. And so that's where we find Abram in Genesis chapter 15. And I don't know, but I imagine he's sitting just looking at a fire and wondering what spectacular disaster is going to happen next. Feeling alone in a strange country and like the world is a particularly unsafe place. Look at verse 1 of Genesis 15. Sometime later, the Lord spoke to Abram in a vision and said to him, "Do not be afraid, Abram, for I will protect you and your reward will be great." But Abram replied, "O sovereign Lord, what good are all your blessings when I don't even have a son? Since you've given me no children, Eliezer of Damascus, a servant in my household, will inherit all my wealth. You have given me no descendants of my own, so one of my servants will be my heir." Why does God say don't be afraid? Well, probably because that's generally what Abram had been feeling. But then God reiterates his promise to not only protect Abram, but to bless him. And I appreciate Abram's foresight here. He's clearly done some estate planning. Right, he's got his will in order. He says, "That's great, but what's the point without any children to inherit what you give me? As it is now, I had to name one of my servants as my heir." Look at verse 4. Then the Lord said to him, "No, your servant will not be your heir, for you will have a son of your own who will be your heir." Then the Lord took Abram outside and said to him, "Look up into the sky and count the stars if you can. That's how many descendants you will have." And Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. This is one of the greatest verses in the Bible. Abram believed God, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of that faith. Now, notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say Abraham or Abram believed in the Lord. It's a subtle difference. It says he believed him. He didn't just believe that God existed, though that would have been pretty easy given that he was talking to him at the moment. But it says he believed him. He believed what God had said, what God had promised, and God counted him as righteous, in right relationship with him. I think too often we're asking the wrong question. Do you believe in God? See, that's not the question. It's not the question that matters. The book of James says even the demons believe in God, and that means nothing. The real question, the question that determines everything in terms of our relationship with God, is do I believe what he says, what he promises? And then God reiterates one of his promises to Abram. Look at verse 7. Then the Lord told him, I am the Lord. I am Yahweh, who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land as your possession. But Abram replied, O sovereign Lord, how can I be sure that I will actually possess it? Now, I don't think we should read this as Abram having doubts. When he says, how can I be sure, he's not doubting. Remember what we just read in verse 6, right? He believed what God said. He's asking, it's more like, so is this like a handshake deal? Or, you know, this was a culture of formal agreements. And Abram is recognizing that God is making a covenant with him. And he wants to know the terms. He wants to know the signs, the guarantees that are expected. So God says, verse 9, I'm going to read a little bit here. The Lord told him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old female goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. So Abram presented all these to him and killed them. Then he cut each animal down the middle and laid the halves side by side. He did not, however, cut the birds in half. Some vultures swooped down to eat the carcasses, but Abram chased them away. As the sun was going down, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a terrifying darkness came down over him. Then the Lord said to Abram, you can be sure that your descendants will be strangers in a foreign land, where they will be oppressed as slaves for 400 years. But I will punish the nation that enslaves them, and in the end they will come away with great wealth. As for you, you will die in peace and be buried at a ripe old age. After 4 generations, your descendants will return here to the land, for the sins of the Amorites do not yet warrant their destruction. After the sun went down and darkness fell, Abram saw a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch pass between the halves of the carcasses. So the Lord made a covenant with Abram that day and said, I have given this land to your descendants, all the way from the border of Egypt to the great Euphrates River, the land now occupied by the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Raphaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. What is going on here? This is one of the most formal covenants people could make in the ancient Near East. To cut a sacrifice in half and walk between the halves was to say, if I break my word, if I break my covenant, my life is forfeit, just as these animals' lives. If I don't keep my promise, do to me what we have done to these animals. Today, we like to sign things. That's how we do it. It's like we're putting our name, and our name is meant to represent us, saying, this is me. Imagine if we did it this way instead. I think we'd probably have fewer breach of contract lawsuits, for sure. But we do something similar when we put our hands over our hearts when making a promise or saying a pledge like the Pledge of Allegiance. Cross my heart and hope to die. Yes, we put our hands over our hearts, the source of life in our body, symbolically saying, if I break this pledge, my life is forfeit. Now, interesting note, before World War II, we had a different salute to the flag when saying the pledge than putting our hands over our hearts. And there it is up there. I have no idea why we changed that. It's horrible. In retrospect, it was a poor choice. God made promises to Abram. And now he seals those promises with as solemn a covenant as they had. And more, he made the covenant one-sided. Did you catch it? Look at verse 17 and 18. He says, after the sun went down and darkness fell, Abram saw a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch pass between the halves of the carcasses. So the Lord made a covenant with Abram that day. God walks between the halves of the sacrifice and makes the covenant with Abram. Smoke and fire pass down through the middle. The same things that the children of Israel would follow in the desert 400 years later, smoke and fire, representations of God's presence. In the original Hebrew, it literally says God cut a covenant with Abram. He made a covenant of blood. And he's telling Abram, I am backing my promises to you with my life, with all that I am. And he allows Abram to sit by the side and watch as he does this. Because his promises, his covenant, rest on who he is, not on Abram's strength or obedience or anything else. Solely on who he is. Okay, so cool story, Bob. What does that have to do with us? I'm really glad you asked. Take a look at Hebrews chapter 6. It's really towards the end of the book, Hebrews in the New Testament. The writer of Hebrews, in context, he's talking about God's promises. And he says in verse 13, for example, there was God's promise to Abraham. Since there was no one greater to swear by, God took an oath in his own name, saying, I will certainly bless you, and I will multiply your descendants beyond number. Then Abraham waited patiently, and he received what God had promised. Now, when people take an oath, they call on someone greater than themselves to hold them to it. And without any question, that oath is binding. God also bound himself with an oath so that those who received the promise could be perfectly sure that he would never change his mind. So God has given both his promise and his oath. These two things are unchangeable because it is impossible for God to lie. Therefore, we who have fled to him for refuge can have great confidence as we hold to the hope that lies before us. This hope is a strong and trustworthy anchor for our souls. It leads us through the curtain into God's inner sanctuary. Jesus has already gone in there for us. He has become our eternal high priest in the order of Melchizedek. We won't talk all about everything there, but Abram lived in a scary world, wars, famines, life was brutal. And he wondered if there was a future for him and for his family. And to reassure him, God to help him not fear, God made promises and bound himself with an oath, a covenant. And Abram's part was simply to believe the promise, to live as if, to live in light of what God had promised him. And the writer of Hebrews said he did so. Abram waited patiently, and he received what God had promised. He's being a little generous here, because did Abram wait patiently? Well, sort of, right? There was that one little issue of Abraham when he was in his late 90s, and he and his wife were really beyond childbearing years, decided that maybe God needed a little help in keeping his promise. And so he slept with his servant Hagar, and he had this son named Ishmael. And anyway, even though Hebrews holds him up as an example of faith, which he was, he wasn't perfect. He wasn't perfect. He didn't keep the covenant. He didn't always live as if and believe what God had said to him. So what does that mean for the covenant? If someone doesn't keep the agreement, I thought there was a death penalty. But God was the only one who walked through the sacrifice and pledged his life. So you see where it's going? A couple thousand years after Abraham, Jesus was having a final dinner, a last supper, with his disciples, and he held up some bread, and we have a poor representation of that here this morning. These little wafers, crackers that we have. But he held up some bread, and he held up some wine, and he said, "This is the new covenant." He's drawing their minds back to God and Abram. He says, This is the next iteration of this covenant, the new covenant between God and humans, a covenant made not with the body and blood of animals, but with my body and my blood," Jesus said. God himself, in the person of Jesus, pays the penalty for our disobedience. He not only sacrifices his life to make the covenant, but lays down his life because we have broken it. The covenant between God and you rests completely on his shoulders, not on yours. God carries the weight of the relationship, the weight of our lives, our souls, our eternities. He put up his life as surety in the covenant with Abraham and his descendants, and he did it again in making a new covenant for us, the spiritual descendants of Abraham. In a few weeks, we are going to walk through the events of Good Friday, which in a way we do every week when we come to this table. We reenact the covenant that God made with us in the sacrifice of Jesus. And just like Abraham could have hope because he believed God would do what he said he would do for him and his descendants, we can have hope that God will do what he has said he will do for us. That his promise to rescue and renew all of creation through the work of Jesus, his promise to save us from judgment, remake the world the way it was meant to be, and to live with us here in a renewed creation in resurrected bodies. All of it he has said and he will do. And the writer of Hebrews says, "Therefore, we who have fled to him for refuge in times just like this, we can have great confidence as we hold to the hope that lies before us." This hope is a strong and and trustworthy anchor for our souls. Do you worry about where things are going? about what is happening. Not just in the world, but in your own life. And I'm not going to say, I'm not going to just, don't worry, be happy. It's not like that. What I am going to say, however, is take your worries to Him. Find refuge in Him. Find your refuge in the one who gives hope. And let that hope be a strong and trustworthy anchor for your soul. If you're here and you don't consider yourself a follower of Jesus, you're just checking things out, let me invite you to come back and walk with us through this next season, through Good Friday, through Easter. Come and discover this Jesus that we talk so much about. Come and discover who He is and what He's done for you in His death and resurrection. In a world where every day the headlines are filled with bad news, come and discover some good, good news of what God has done in Jesus and what He wants to do in you. And if you're here and you do consider yourself a follower of Jesus, I just want to urge you to think about what it means not just to believe in Him, but to believe what He says and to act on it, to live as if. Being a follower of Jesus doesn't mean that the crazy things in the world that are happening in the world have no impact on us. But it does mean that we look at everything that is going on around us through the lens of the larger story of God's promises and His covenant oath to us. We have hope in the one who said, "I will make all things new. I will wipe away every tear. Death will not win." That hope is an anchor for our souls, no matter how stormy it might be getting outside. And that means I can approach life in an entirely different way when I know that I am always safe in the unshakable kingdom of God. Would you pray with me? God, You know our hearts. You do not blame us for being fearful in fearful times. You do not blame us for being worried for our children and the future we are leaving to them. But You do invite us in the midst of that fear and that worry to find our refuge in You, in the one who has promised and who will deliver, who has promised us new life and given us Jesus and His death and resurrection as a foretaste of what is to come. God, we long for the day when You will make all things new. Come quickly, Lord Jesus. Come quickly. Amen. I want to invite you this morning as we sing this last song to come to the table, to take the bread and the juice, the symbol of Christ's sacrifice for you, and to know that as you do that, you are receiving the very promise of God, the promise of forgiveness, of new life, of new creation. So come, don't take it lightly, but know that His promise rests not on your obedience, but on His character, who He is, and what He has done for you. Come and receive.
Thanks again for listening. Make sure to subscribe to get the weekly episodes in your podcast feed. You can find out more on how to get connected with Redemption Hill at redemptionboise.org/connection, where you can fill out the Connect card and start your journey today. For regular encouragement throughout the week, follow us on Instagram at Redemption Boise. We are so glad you're here and are excited to accompany you in your story with God. We hope to see you soon.